what had been Rosette's bedroom. Lee stood where he was for a moment, then went to the fridge, took something out, and began to eat it. Late the following day, just as Lee and Marina were sitting down to supper, June lay on the living room floor, kicking her legs on a blanket. Marguerite came puffing down the street from the Winscott Road bus stop. This evening she was wearing blue slacks that were unfortunate, considering the generous spread of her butt. She was toting a large cloth bag. Poking out of the top was the red plastic roof of a child's playhouse. She walked up the porch steps, once more deftly avoiding the bad one, and marched in without knocking. I fought against the temptation to get my directional mic. This was another scene I did not need to be privy to, and lost. There's nothing so fascinating as a family argument. I think Leo Tolstoy said that. Or maybe it was Jonathan Franzen. By the time I got it plugged in and aimed through my open window at the open window across the street, the rhubarb was in full swing. Wanted you to know where we were, I would have damn well told you. They'd have told me. She's a good girl, Marguerite said placidly. Lee's rage washed over her like a light summer shower. She was unloading mismatched dishes onto the counter with the speed of a blackjack dealer. Marina was looking at her with outright amazement. The playhouse sat on the floor next to June's baby blanket. June kicked her legs and ignored it. Of course she ignored it. What's a four-month-old going to do with a playhouse? Ma, you have to leave us alone. You have to stop bringing things. I can take care of my family. Marina added her 2 cents worth. Mamushka, lisez no. Marguerite laughed merrily. Lisez no, lisez no. Honey, Lee always say no. This little man been doing it all his life, and it doesn't mean a thing. Ma takes care of him. She pinched his cheek the way a mother would pinch the cheek of a 6-year-old after he has done something naughty but undeniably cute. If Marina had tried that, I'm sure Lee would have knocked her block off. At some point, the jump rope girls had drifted onto the bald excuse for a lawn. They watched the argument as attentively as globe groundlings checking out the newest Shakespeare offering in the standing room section. Only in the play we were watching, the shrew was going to come out on top. What did she make you for dinner, honey? Was it something good? We had stew. Zarkoya. That guy Gregory sent some coupons for the ShopRite. His mouth worked. Marguerite waited. Did you want some, ma? Zarkoya, pretty okay, mamushka, Marina said with a hopeful smile. No, I couldn't eat anything like that, Marguerite said. Hell, Ma, you don't even know what it is. It was as if he hadn't spoken. It would upset my stomach. Besides, I don't want to be on a city bus after 8 o'clock. There are too many drunk men on them after 8 o'clock. Lee, honey, you need to fix that step before someone breaks a leg. He muttered something, but Marguerite's attention had moved elsewhere. She swooped down like a hawk on a field mouse and grabbed June. With my binoculars, the baby's startled expression was unmistakable. How's my little cutie tonight? How's my dear one? How's my little Davushka? Her little Davushka, scared shitless, began to scream her head off. Lee made a move to take the baby. Marguerite's red lips peeled back from her teeth in what could have been a grin, but only if you wanted to be charitable. It looked more like a snarl to me. It must have to her son, too, because he stepped back. Marina was biting her lip, her eyes wide with dismay.
Ooh, Junie! Junie Mooney Spoonie!
Marguerite marched back and forth across the threadbare green carpet, ignoring June's increasingly distressed wails, just as she'd ignored Lee's anger. Was she actually feeding on those wails? It looked that way to me. After a while, Marina could bear it no longer. She got up and went to Marguerite, who steamed away from her, holding the baby to her breasts. Even from across the street, I could imagine the sound of her big white nurse's shoes. Clud, clump, clud. Marina followed her. Marguerite, perhaps feeling her point was made, at last surrendered the baby. She pointed at Lee, then spoke to Marina in her loud English instructor's voice.
He gained weight when you were staying with me, because I fixed him all the things he likes, but he's still too damned skinny.
Marina was looking at her over the top of the baby's head, her pretty eyes wide. Marguerite rolled her own, either in impatience or outright disgust, and put her face down to Marina's. The leaning lamp of Pisa was turned on, and the light skated across the lenses of Marguerite's cat's-eyes glasses.
Fix him what he'll eat. No soured cream, no yogurt. He's too skinny.
Skinny?
Marina said doubtfully. Safe in her mother's arms, June's weeping was winding down to watery hiccups.
Yes,
Marguerite said. Then she whirled to Lee.
Fix that step.
With that she left, only pausing to put a large smack on her granddaughter's head. When she walked back toward the bus stop, she was smiling. She looked younger. On the morning after Marguerite brought the playhouse, I was up at 6. I went to the drawn drapes and peeked out through the crack without even thinking about it. Spying on the house across the street had become a habit. Marina was sitting in one of the lawn chairs, smoking a cigarette. She was wearing pink rayon pajamas that were far too big for her. She had a new black eye, and there were spots of blood on the pajama shirt. She smoked slowly, inhaling deeply and staring out at nothing. After a while, she went back inside and made breakfast. Pretty soon, Lee came out and ate it. He didn't look at her. He read a book. That guy Gregory sent some coupons for the ShopRite, Lee had told his mother, perhaps to explain the meat in the stew. Maybe just to inform her that he and Marina weren't alone and friendless in Fort Worth. That appeared to have passed unnoticed by Mamushka, but it didn't pass unnoticed by me. Peter Gregory was the first link in the chain that would lead George de Morenschild to Mercedes Street. Like de Morenschild, Gregory was a Russian expat in the petroleum biz. He was originally from Siberia and taught Russian one night a week at the Fort Worth Library. Lee discovered this and called for an appointment to ask if he, Lee, could possibly get work as a translator. Gregory gave him a test and found his Russian passable. What Gregory was really interested in, what all the expats were interested in, Lee must have felt, was the former Marina Prusakova, a young girl from Minsk who had somehow managed to escape the clutches of the Russian bear, only to wind up in those of an American boar. Lee didn't get the job. Gregory hired Marina instead to give his son, Paul, Russian lessons. It was money the Oswalds desperately needed. It was also something else for Lee to resent. She was tutoring a rich kid twice a week while he was stuck putting together screen doors. The morning I observed Marina smoking on the porch, Paul Gregory, good-looking and about Marina's age, pulled up in a brand new Buick. He knocked, and Marina, wearing heavy makeup that made me think of Bobby Jill, opened the door. Either mindful of Lee's possessiveness or because of rules of propriety she had learned back home, she gave him his lesson on the porch. It lasted an hour and a half. June lay between them on her blanket, and when she cried, the two of them took turns holding her. It was a nice little scene, although Mr. Oswald would probably not have thought so. Around noon, Paul's father pulled up behind the Buick. There were two men and two women with him. They brought groceries. The elder Gregory hugged his son, then kissed Marina on the cheek, the one that wasn't swollen. There was a lot of talk in Russian. The younger Gregory was lost, but Marina was found. She lit up like a neon sign. She invited them in. Soon they were sitting in the living room, drinking iced tea and talking. Marina's hands flew like excited birds. June went from hand to hand and lap to lap. I was fascinated. The Russian emigre community had found the girl woman who had become their darling. How could she be anything else? She was young. She was a stranger in a strange land. She was beautiful. Of course, beauty happened to be married to the Beast, a surly young American who hit her, bad, and who believed passionately in a system these upper-middle-class folks had just as passionately rejected. Far worse. Yet Lee would accept their groceries with only occasional outbursts of temper, and when they came with furnishings, a new bed, a bright pink crib for the baby, he accepted these too. He hoped the Russians would get him out of the hole he was in, but he didn't like them. And by the time he moved his family to Dallas in November of 62, he must have known his feelings were heartily reciprocated. Why would they like him, he must have thought. He was ideologically pure. They were cowards who had abandoned Mother Russia when she was on her knees in 43, who'd licked the Germans' jackboots and then fled to the United States when the war was over, quickly embracing the American way, which to Oswald meant saber-rattling, minority-oppressing, worker-exploiting crypto-fascism. Some of this I knew from Al's notes. Most of it I saw played out on the stage across the street, or deduced from the only important conversation my lamp bug picked up and recorded. On the evening of August 25th, a Saturday, Marina dolled up in a pretty blue dress and popped June into a corduroy romper with appliqued flowers on the front. Lee, looking sour, emerged from the bedroom in what had to be his only suit. It was a moderately hilarious wool box that could only have been made in Russia. It was a hot night, and I imagined he would be wringing with sweat before it was over. They walked carefully down the porch steps, the bad one still hadn't been fixed, and set off for the bus stop. I got into my car and drove up to the corner of Mercedes Street and Winscott Road. I could see them standing by the telephone pole with its white painted stripe, arguing. Big surprise there. The bus came. The Oswalds got on. I followed just as I had followed Frank Dunning in Derry. History repeats itself is another way of saying the past harmonizes. They got off the bus in a residential neighborhood on the north side of Dallas. I parked and watched them walk down to a small but handsome field stone and timber Tudor house. The carriage lamps at the end of the walk glowed softly in the dusk. There was no crabgrass on this lawn. Everything about the place shouted, "America works." Marina led the way to the house with the baby in her arms, Lee lagging slightly behind, looking lost in his double-breasted jacket, which swung almost to the back of his knees. Marina pushed Lee in front of her and pointed at the bell. He rang it. Peter Gregory and his son came out, and when June put her arms out to Paul, the young man laughed and took her. Lee's mouth twitched downward when he saw this. Another man came out. I recognized him from the group that had arrived on the day of Paul Gregory's first language lesson. And he had been back to the Oswald place three or four times since, bringing groceries, toys for June, or both. I was pretty sure his name was George Boo. Yes, another George. The past harmonizes in all sorts of ways. And although he was pushing 60, I had an idea he was seriously crushing on Marina. According to the short-order cook who'd gotten me into this, Boo was the one who persuaded Peter Gregory to throw the get-acquainted party. George de Morenschild wasn't there, but he'd hear about it shortly thereafter. Boo would tell de Morenschild about the Oswalds and their peculiar marriage. He would also tell de Morenschild that Lee Oswald had made a scene at the party, praising socialism and the Russian collectives. The young man strikes me as crazy, Boo would say. De Morenschild, a lifelong connoisseur of crazy, would decide he had to meet this odd couple for himself. Why did Oswald blow his top at Peter Gregory's party, offending the well-meaning expats who might otherwise have helped him? I didn't know for sure, but I had a pretty good idea. There's Marina, charming them all, especially the men, in her blue dress. There's June, pretty as a Woolworth's baby picture in her charity jumper with the sewn-on flowers. And there's Lee, sweating in his ugly suit. He's keeping up with the rapid ebb and flow of Russian better than young Paul Gregory, but in the end, he's still left behind. It must have infuriated him to have to kowtow to these people and to eat their salt. I hope it did. I hope it hurt. I didn't linger. What I cared about was De Morenschild, the next link in the chain. He would arrive on stage soon. Meanwhile, all three Oswalds were finally out of 2703 and would be until at least 10 o'clock, given that the following day was Sunday, maybe even later. I drove back to activate the bug in their living room. Mercedes Street was partying hardy that Saturday night, but the field behind Shea Oswald was silent and deserted. I thought my key would work on the back door as well as the front, but that was a theory I never had to test because the back door was unlocked. During my time in Fort Worth, I never once used the key I'd purchased from Ivy Templeton. Life is full of ironies. The place was heartbreakingly neat. The high chair had been placed between the parents' seats at the little table in the kitchen where they took their meals, the tray wiped gleaming clean. The same was true of the peeling surface of the counter and the sink with its rusty hard water ring. I made a bet with myself that Marina would have left Rosette's jumper-clad girls and went into what was now June's room to check. I had brought a penlight and shined it around the walls. Yes, they were still there, although in the dark they were more ghostly than cheerful. June probably looked at them as she lay in her crib sucking her baki. I wondered if she would remember them later on some deep level of her mind. Crayola ghost girls. Chimla, I thought, for no reason at all, and shivered. I moved the bureau, attached the tap wire to the lamp's plug, and fed it through the hole I'd drilled in the wall. All fine. But then I had a bad moment. Very bad. When I moved the bureau back into place, it bumped against the wall and the leaning lamp of Pisa toppled. If I'd had time to think, I would have frozen in place and the damn thing would have shattered on the floor. Then what? Remove the bug and leave the pieces? Hope they'd accept the idea that the lamp, unsteady to begin with, had fallen on its own? Most people would buy that, but most people don't have reason to be paranoid about the FBI. Lee might find the hole I'd drilled in the wall. If he did, the butterfly would spread its wings. But I didn't have time to think. I reached out and caught the lamp on the way down. Then I just stood there holding it and shaking. It was hot as an oven in the little house, and I could smell the stink of my own sweat. Would they smell it when they came back? How could they not? I wondered if I were mad. Surely the smart thing would be to remove the bug and then remove myself. I could reconnect with Oswald on April 10th of next year. Watch him try to assassinate General Edwin Walker, and if he was on his own, I could then kill him just as I had Frank Dunning. KISS, K-I-S-S, as they say in Christie's AA meetings. Keep it simple, stupid. Why in God's name was I fucking with a bugged thrift shop lamp when the future of the world was at stake? It was Al Templeton who answered. You're here because the window of uncertainty is still open. You're here because if George de Morenschild is more than he appears, then maybe Oswald wasn't the one. You're here to save Kennedy, and making sure starts now. So put that fucking lamp back where it belongs. I put the lamp back where it belonged, although its unsteadiness worried me. What if Lee knocked it off the bureau himself and saw the bug inside when the ceramic base shattered? For that matter, what if Lee and De Morenschild conversed in this room, but with the lamp off, and in tones too low for my long-distance mic to pick up? Then it all would have been for nothing. You'll never make an omelet thinking that way, buddy. What convinced me was the thought of Sadie. I loved her and she loved me, at least she had. And I'd thrown that away to come here to this shitty street. And by Christ, I wasn't going to leave without at least trying to hear what George De Morenschild had to say for himself. I slipped through the back door and, with the penlight clamped in my teeth, connected the tap wire to the tape recorder. I slid the recorder into a rusty Crisco can to protect it from the elements, then concealed it in the little nest of bricks and boards I'd already prepared. Then I went back to my own shitty little house on that shitty little street and began to wait. They never used the lamp until it got almost too dark to see. Saving on the electricity bill, I suppose. Besides, Lee was a working man. He went to bed early, and she went when he did. The first time I checked the tape, what I had was mostly Russian, and draggy Russian at that, given the super slow speed of the recorder. If Marina tried out her English vocabulary, Lee would reprimand her. Nevertheless, he sometimes spoke to June in English if the baby was fussy, always in low, soothing tones. Sometimes he even sang to her. The super slow recordings made him sound like an orc trying its hand at "Rock-a-bye, baby." Twice I heard him hit Marina, and the second time Russian wasn't good enough to express his rage. "You worthless, nagging cunt. I guess maybe my ma was right about you." This was followed by the slam of a door and the sound of Marina crying. It cut out abruptly as she turned off the lamp. On the evening of September 4th, I saw a kid, 13 or so, come to the Oswald's door with a canvas sack over his shoulder. Lee, barefoot and dressed in a T-shirt and jeans, opened up. They spoke. Lee invited him inside. They spoke some more. At one point, Lee picked up a book and showed it to the kid, who looked at it dubiously. There was no chance of using the directional mic because the weather had turned cool and the windows over there were shut. But the leaning lamp of Pisa was on, and when I retrieved the second tape late the following night, I was treated to an amusing conversation. By the third time I played it, I hardly heard the slow drag of the voices. The kid was selling subscriptions to a newspaper, or maybe it was a magazine, called Grit. He informed the Oswalds that it had all sorts of interesting stuff the New York papers couldn't be bothered with. He labeled this country news, plus sports and gardening tips. It also had what he called fiction stories and comic strips. "You won't get Dixie Dugan in the Times Herald," he informed them. "My mama loves Dixie." "Well, son, that's fine," Lee said. "You're quite the little businessman, aren't you?" "Yes, sir." "Tell me how much you make."
"I don't get but 4 cents on every dime, but that ain't the big thing, sir. Mostly what I like is the prizes. They're way better than the ones you get selling Cloverine salve. Nuts to that. I'm going to get me a .22. My dad said I could have it."
"Son, do you know you're being exploited?"
"Huh?"
"They take the dimes. You get pennies and the promise of a rifle."
"Lee, he nice boy," Marina said. "Be nice. Leave alone."
Lee ignored her.
"You need to know what's in this book, son."
"Can you read what's on the front?"
"Oh, yes, sir. It says The Condition of the Working Class by Friedrich Engels."
"Engels. It's all about what happens to boys who think they're going to wind up millionaires by selling stuff door to door."
I don't want to be no millionaire, the boy objected. I just want a .22 so I can plink rats at the dump like my friend Hank.
You make pennies selling their newspapers. They make dollars selling your sweat and the sweat of a million boys like you. The free market isn't free. You need to educate yourself, son. I did, and I started when I was just your age. Lee gave the Grit newsboy a 10-minute lecture on the evils of capitalism, complete with choice quotes from Karl Marx. The boy listened patiently, then asked,
So, you gonna buy a subscription?
Son, have you listened to a single word I've said?
Yes, sir.
Then you should know that this system has stolen from me, just as it's stealing from you and your family.
You broke? Why didn't you say so?
What I've been trying to do is explain to you why I'm broke.
Well, golly, I could have tried three more houses, but now I have to go home because it's almost my curfew.
Good luck, Marina said. The front door squalled open on its old hinges, then rattled shut. It was too tired to thump. There was a long silence, then Lee said in a flat voice, You see, that's what we're up against. Not long after, the lamp went out. My new phone stayed mostly silent. Deke called once, one of those quick how-you-doing duty calls, but that was all. I told myself I couldn't expect more. School was back in, and the first few weeks were always harum-scarum. Deke was busy because Miss Ellie had unretired him. He told me that, after some grumbling, he had allowed her to put his name on the substitute list. Ellie wasn't calling because she had 5,000 things to do and probably 500 little brush fires to put out. I realized only after Deke hung up that he hadn't mentioned Sadie. And two nights after Lee's lecture to the newsboy, I decided I had to talk to her. I had to hear her voice, even if all she had to say was, Please don't call me, George, it's over. As I reached for the phone, it rang. I picked it up and said with complete certainty, Hello, Sadie. Hello, honey. There was a moment of silence long enough for me to think I'd been wrong after all, that someone is going to say, I'm not Sadie, I'm just some putz who dialed a wrong number. Then she said, How did you know it was me? I almost said harmonics, and she might have understood that, but might wasn't good enough. This was an important call, and I didn't want to screw it up. Desperately didn't want to screw it up. Through most of what followed, there were two of me on the phone. George, who was speaking out loud, and Jake on the inside saying all the things George couldn't. Maybe there are always two on each end of the conversation when good love hangs in the balance. Because I've been thinking about you all day, I said. I've been thinking of you all summer. How are you? I'm fine. I'm lonely. How about you? How was your summer? Did you get it done? Have you cut your legal ties to your weird husband? Yes. She said, Done deal. Isn't that one of the things you say, George? Done deal? I guess so. How's school? How's the library? George, are we going to talk like this, or are we going to talk? All right. I sit down on my lumpy second-hand couch. Let's talk. Are you okay? Yes, but I'm unhappy. And I'm very confused. She hesitated, then said, I was working at Harrah's, you probably know that, as a cocktail waitress, and I met somebody.
Oh?
Oh, shit.
Yes, a very nice man, charming, a gentleman, just shy of 40. His name is Roger Beaton. He's an aide to the Republican senator from California, Tom Kutchel. He's the minority whip in the Senate. You know, Kutchel, I mean, not Roger.
She laughed, but not the way you do when something's funny. Should I be glad you met someone nice? I don't know, George. Are you glad? No.
I want to kill him.
Roger is handsome, she said in a flat, just-the-facts voice. He's pleasant. He went to Yale. He knows how to show a girl a good time. And he's tall. The second me would no longer keep silent. I want to kill him. That made her laugh, and the sound of it was a relief. I'm not telling you this to hurt you or make you feel bad. Really? Then why are you telling me? We went out 3 or 4 times. He kissed me. We made out a little, just necking like kids.
I not only want to kill him, I want to do it slowly.
But it wasn't the same. Maybe it could be in time. Maybe not. He gave me his number in Washington and told me to call him if I... How did he put it? If you get tired of shelving books and carrying a torch for the one that got away. I think that was the gist of it. He says he's going places and that he needs a good woman to go with him. He thought I might be that woman. Of course, men say stuff like that. I'm not as naive as I once was, but sometimes they mean it.
Sadie.
Still, it wasn't quite the same. She sounded thoughtful, absent. And for the first time I wondered if something other than doubt about her personal life might be wrong with her. If she might be sick. On the plus side, there was no broom in evidence. Of course, sometimes men hide the broom, don't they? Johnny did. You did too, George.
Sadie?
Yes?
Are you hiding a broom?
There was a long moment of silence, much longer than the one when I'd answered the phone with her name, and much longer than I expected. At last she said,
I don't know what you mean.
You don't sound like yourself, that's all. I told you I'm very confused, and I'm sad, because you're still not ready to tell me the truth, are you?
If I could, I would.
You know something interesting. You have good friends in Jody, not just me, and none of them know where you live.
Sadie,
you say it's Dallas, but you're on the Elmhurst Exchange, and Elmhurst is Fort Worth.
I'd never thought of that. What else hadn't I thought of?
Sadie, all I can tell you is that what I'm doing is very important.
Oh, I'm sure it is, and what Senator Kuchel's doing is very important, too.
Roger was at pains to tell me that, to tell me that if I joined him in Washington, I would be more or less sitting at the feet of greatness or in the doorway to history or something like that. Power excites him. It was one of the few things it was hard to like about him. What I still think is, who am I to sit at the feet of greatness? I'm just a divorced librarian.
Who am I to stand in the doorway to history?
I said.
What? What did you say, George?
Nothing, hon. Maybe you better not call me that.
Sorry.
I'm not.
What exactly are we talking about?
You and me. And whether or not that still makes an us. It would help if you could tell me why you're in Texas, because I know you didn't come to write a book or teach school.
Telling you could be dangerous.
We're all in danger, she said. Johnny's right about that.
Will I tell you something Roger told me?
All right. Where did he tell you, Sadie? And were the two of you vertical or horizontal when the conversation took place?
He'd had a drink or two, and he got gossipy. We were in his hotel room, but don't worry, I kept my feet on the floor and all my clothes on.
I wasn't worrying. If you weren't, I'm disappointed in you.
All right, I was worried.
What did he say?
He said there's a rumor that there's going to be some sort of major deal in the Caribbean this fall or winter.
A flashpoint, he called it. I'm assuming he meant Cuba.
He said, that idiot JFK is going to put us all in the soup just to show he's got balls.
I remembered all the end-of-the-world crap her former husband had poured into her ears.
"Anyone who reads the paper can see it coming," he'd told her. "We'll die with sores all over our bodies and coughing up our lungs."
Stuff like that leaves an impression, especially when spoken in tones of dry scientific certainty.
Leaves an impression. A scar, more like it.
"Sadie, that's crap."
"Oh?"
She sounded nettled. "I suppose you have the inside scoop, and Senator Kutchel doesn't?"
"Let's say I do."
"Let's not.
I'll wait for you to come clean a little longer, but not much.
Maybe just because you're a good dancer."
"Then let's go dancing," I said a little wildly. "Good night, George." And before I could say anything else, she hung up.
I started to call her back, but when the operator said, "Number, please," sanity reasserted itself. I put the phone back in its cradle.
She had said what she needed to say. Trying to get her to say more would only make things worse. I tried to tell myself that her call had been nothing but a stratagem to get me off the dime, a speak-for-yourself John Alden kind of thing. It wouldn't work because that wasn't Sadie. It had seemed more like a cry for help.
I picked up the phone again, and this time when the operator asked for a number, I gave her one. The phone rang twice on the other end, and then Ellen Dougherty said,
"Yes, who is it, please?"
"Hi, Miss Ellie, it's me, George." Maybe that moment of silence thing was catching. I waited. Then she said,
"Hello, George. I've been neglecting you, haven't I? It's just that I've been awfully
busy, sure. I know what the first week or two's like, Ellie. I called because Sadie just called me."
"Oh?"
She sounded very cautious. "If you told her my number was on a Fort Worth exchange instead of Dallas, it's okay." "I wasn't gossiping. I hope you understand that. I thought she had a right to know.
I care for Sadie. Of course I care for you too, George, but you're gone. She's not."
I did understand, although it hurt. The feeling of being in a space capsule bound for the outer depths recurred.
"I'm fine with that, Ellie, and it really wasn't much of a fib. I expect to be moving to Dallas soon."
No response. And what could she say? "Perhaps you are, but we both know you're a bit of a liar." I didn't like the way she sounded. "Does she seem all right to you?"
"I'm not sure I want to answer that question. If I said no, you might come roaring down to see her, and she doesn't want to see you. Not as things stand."
Actually, she had answered my question.
"Was she okay when she came back?"
"She was fine. Glad to see us all."
"But now she sounds distracted and says she feels sad."
"Is that so surprising?"
Miss Ellie spoke with asperity. "There are lots of memories here for Sadie. Many of them connected to a man she still has feelings for. A nice man and a lovely teacher, but one who arrived flying false colors."
That one really hurt.
It seemed like something else. She spoke about some sort of coming crisis that she heard about from the Yaley who was sitting in the doorway of history.
From someone she met in Nevada. Her husband filled her head with a lot of nonsense. Her head. Her pretty little head.
Not just asperity now, outright anger. It made me feel small and mean. "George, I have a stack of folders a mile high in front of me, and I need to get to them.
You cannot psychoanalyze Sadie Dunhill at long distance, and I cannot help you with your love life. The only thing I can do is to advise you to come clean if you care for her. Sooner rather than later."
"You haven't seen her husband around, I suppose."
"No! Good night, George."
For the second time that night, a woman I cared about hung up on me. That was a new personal record. I went into the bedroom and began to undress. fine when she arrived, glad to be back with all her Jody friends. Not so fine now, because she was torn between the handsome, on-the-fast-track-to-success new guy and the tall, dark stranger with the invisible past. That would probably be the case in a romance novel, but if it was the case here, why hadn't she been down at the mouth when she came back? An unpleasant thought occurred to me. Maybe she was drinking. A lot. Secretly. Wasn't it possible my wife had been a secret heavy drinker for years, before I married her, in fact? And the past harmonizes with itself. It would be easy to dismiss that, to say that Miss Ellie would have spotted the signs, but drunks can be clever. Sometimes it's years before people start to get wise. If Sadie was showing up for work on time, Ellie might not notice that she was doing so with bloodshot eyes and mints on her breath. The idea was probably ridiculous. All my suppositions were suspect, each one colored by how much I still cared for Sadie. I lay back on my bed looking up at the ceiling. In the living room, the oil stove gurgled. It was another cool night.
"Let it go, buddy," Al said. "You have to. Remember, you're not here to get
the girl, the gold watch, and everything." "Yeah, Al, got it."
"Besides, she's probably fine. You're the one with the problem."
More than just one, actually. And it was a long time before I fell asleep. The following Monday, when I made one of my regular drive-bys of 214 West Neely Street in Dallas, I observed a long gray funeral hack parked in the driveway. The two fat ladies were standing on the porch watching a couple of men in dark suits lift a stretcher into the rear. On it was a sheeted form. On the tottery-looking balcony above the porch, the young couple from the upstairs apartment was also watching. Their youngest child was sleeping in his mother's arms. The wheelchair with the ashtray clamped to the arm stood orphaned under the tree where the old man had spent most of his days last summer. I pulled over and stood by my car until the hearse left. Then, although I realized the timing was rather, shall we say, crass, I crossed the street and walked up the path to the porch. At the foot of the stairs, I tipped my hat. "Ladies, I'm very sorry for your loss." The older of the two, the wife, who was now a widow, I assumed, said,
"You've been here before."
"Indeed I have," I thought of saying. "This thing is bigger than pro football."
"He saw you."
Not accusing, just stating a fact. "I've been looking for an apartment in this neighborhood." "Will you be keeping this one?"
"No,"
the younger one said.
"He had some insurance, about the only thing he did have, except for some medals in a box."
She sniffed. "I tell you, it broke my heart a little to see how grief-stricken those two ladies were."
"He said you was a ghost," the widow told me. "He said he could see right through you. Of course, he was as crazy as a shithouse mouse. Last 3 years, ever since he had his stroke and they put him on that pee bag. Me and Ida's going back to Oklahoma."
"Trimozelle," I thought. "That's where you're supposed to go when you give up your apartment."
"What do you want?" the younger one asked. "We got to take him a suit on down to the funerary home."
"I'd like the number of your landlord," I said. The widow's eyes gleamed.
"What'd it be worth to you, mister?"
"I'll give it to you for free,"
said the young woman on the second-floor balcony. The bereaved daughter looked up and told her to shut her fucking mouth. That was the thing about Dallas. Derry, too.
Neighborly.
Chapter 19. George de Morenschildt made his grand entrance on the afternoon of September 15th, a dark and rainy Saturday. He was behind the wheel of a coffee-colored Cadillac right out of a Chuck Berry song. With him was a man I knew, George Boo, and one I didn't, a skinny whip of a guy with a fuzz of white hair and the ramrod back of a fellow who spent a good deal of time in the military and is still happy about it. De Morenschild went around to the back of the car and opened the trunk. I dashed to get the distance mic. When I came back with my gear, Boo had a folded-up playpen under his arm, and the military-looking guy had an armload of toys. De Morenschild was empty-handed and mounted the steps in front of the other two with his head up and his chest thrown out. He was tall and powerfully built. His graying hair was combed slantwise back from his broad forehead in a way that said, to me at least, "Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair, for I am George." I plugged in the tape recorder, put on the headphones, and tilted the mic-equipped bowl across the street. Marina was out of sight. Lee was sitting on the couch, reading a thick paperback by the light of the lamp on the bureau. When he heard footsteps on the porch, he looked up with a frown and tossed his book on the coffee table. More goddamn expats, he might have been thinking. But he went to answer the knock. He held out his hand to the silver-haired stranger on his porch, but De Morenschild surprised him and me by pulling Lee into his arms and bussing him on both cheeks. Then he held him back by the shoulders. His voice was deep and accented. German rather than Russian, I thought.
"Let me look at a young man who has journeyed so far and come back with his ideals intact."
Then he pulled Lee into another hug. Oswald's head just showed above the bigger man's shoulder, and I saw something even more surprising. Lee Harvey Oswald was smiling. Marina came out of the baby's room with June in her arms. She exclaimed with pleasure when she saw Boo and thanked him for the playpen and what she called in her stilted English, "the child's planks." Boo introduced the skinny man as Lawrence Orlov, Colonel Lawrence Orlov, if you please, and De Morenschild as a friend of the Russian community. Boo and Orlov went to work setting the playpen up in the middle of the floor. Marina stood with them, chatting in Russian. Like Boo, Orlov couldn't seem to take his eyes off the young Russian mother. Marina was wearing a smock top and shorts showcasing legs that went up forever. Lee's smile was gone. He was retreating into his usual gloom. Only De Morenschild wouldn't let him. He spotted Lee's paperback, sprang to the coffee table, and picked it up.
"Atlas shrugged,"
speaking just to Lee, completely ignoring the others who were admiring the new playpen.
"Ayn Rand, what is a young revolutionary doing with this?"
"Know your enemy," Lee said, and when De Morenschild burst into a hearty roar of laughter, Lee's smile resurfaced.
"And what do you make of Miss Rand's cri de coeur?"
That struck a chord when I played the tape back. I listened to the comment twice before it clicked. It was almost exactly the same phrase Mimi Corcoran had used when asking me about the catcher in the rye.
"I think she swallowed the poison bait," Oswald said. "Now she's making money by selling it to other people." "Exactly, mein friend. I've never heard it put better. There will come a day when the rents of the world will answer for their crimes. Do you believe that?"
"I know it," Lee said. He spoke matter-of-factly. De Morenschild patted the couch.
"Sit by me. I want to hear of your adventures in the homeland."
But first, Boo and Orlov approached Lee and De Morenschild. There was a lot of back and forth in Russian. Lee looked dubious, but when De Morenschild said something to him, also in Russian, Lee nodded and spoke briefly to Marina. The way he flicked his hand at the door made it pretty clear. "Go on, then, go." De Morenschild tossed his car keys to Boo, who fumbled them. De Morenschild and Lee exchanged a look of shared amusement as Boo grubbed them off the dirty green carpet. Then they left, Marina carrying the baby in her arms, and drove off in De Morenschild's boat of a Cadillac.
"Now," We have peace, mein Freund, de Mohrenschild said. And the men will open their wallets, which is good, yes? I get tired of them always opening their wallets, Lee said. Rena's starting to forget that we didn't come back to America just to buy a damn freezer and a bunch of dresses. De Mohrenschild waved this away. Sweat from the back of the capitalist hog. Man, isn't it enough that you live in this depressing place? Lee said, it sure isn't much, is it? De Mohrenschild clapped him on the back, almost hard enough to knock the smaller man off the couch. Cheer up. What you take now, you give back 1,000-fold later. Isn't that what you believe? And when Lee nodded, now, tell me how things stand in Russia, comrade. May I call you comrade, or have you repudiated that form of address? You can call me anything but late to dinner, Oswald said and laughed. I could see him opening to De Mohrenschild the way a flower opens to the sun after days of rain. Lee talked about Russia. He was long-winded and pompous. I wasn't very interested in his rap about how the communist bureaucracy had hijacked all the country's wonderful pre-war socialist ideals. He passed over Stalin's Great Purge in the 30s. Nor was I interested in his judgment that Nikita Khrushchev was an idiot. You could hear the same idle bullshit about American leaders in any barbershop or shoeshine parlor right here. Oswald might be going to change the course of history in a mere 14 months, but he was a bore. What interested me was the way De Mohrenschild listened. He did it as the world's more charming and magnetic people do, always asking the right question at the right time, never fidgeting or taking his eyes from the speaker's face, making the other guy feel like the most knowledgeable, brilliant, and intellectually savvy person on the planet. This might have been the first time in his life that Lee had been listened to in such a way. There's only one hope for socialism that I see, Lee finished, and that's Cuba. There, the revolution is still pure. I hope to go there one day. I may become a citizen. De Mohrenschild nodded gravely. You could do far worse. I have been, many times, before the current administration made it difficult to travel there. It is a beautiful country, and now, thanks to Fidel, it's a beautiful country that belongs to the people who live there. I know it. Lee's face was shining. But, De Mohrenschild raised a lecturely finger, if you believe the American capitalists will let Fidel, Raoul, and Che work their magic without interference, you're living in a dream world. Already the wheels are turning. Do you know this fellow Walker? My ears picked up. Edwin Walker? The general who got fired? The very one. I know him. Lives in Dallas. Ran for governor and got his ass kicked. Then he goes over to Mississippi to stand with Ross Barnett when James Meredith integrated Ole Miss. He's just another segregationist little Hitler. A racist, certainly, but for him, the segregationist cows and the Klan Bobos are just a blind. He sees the push for Negro rights as a club to beat at the socialist principles that so haunt him and his ilk. James Meredith, a communist. The NAACP, a front. SNCC, black on top, red inside. Sure, Lee said, it's how they work. I couldn't tell if De Mohrenschild was actually invested in the things he was saying, or if he was just winding Lee up for the hell of it. And what do the Walkers and the Barnetts and the capering revivalist preachers like Billy Graham and Billy James Haggis see as the beating heart of this evil, nigger-loving communist monster? Russia! I know it! And where do they see the grasping hand of communism just 90 miles from the shores of the United States? Cuba! Walker no longer wears the uniform, but his best friend does. Do you know who I'm talking about? Lee shook his head. His eyes never left De Mohrenschild's face. Curtis LeMay, another racist
who sees communists behind every bush. What do Walker and LeMay insist that Kennedy do? Bomb Cuba. Then invade Cuba, then make Cuba the 51st state. Their humiliation at the Bay of Pigs has only made them more determined.
De Morenschild made his own exclamation marks by pounding his fist on his thigh.
Men like LeMay and Walker are far more dangerous than Durant Beach, and not because they have guns, because they have followers.
I know the danger, Lee said. I've started organizing a hands-off Cuba group here, in Fort Worth. I've got a dozen people interested already.
That was bold. To the best of my knowledge, the only thing Lee had been organizing in Fort Worth was a passel of aluminum screen doors, plus the backyard clothes whirligig on the few occasions when Marina could persuade him to hang the baby's diapers on it.
You'd better work fast, De Morenschild said grimly. Cuba's a billboard for revolution. When the suffering people of Nicaragua and Haiti or the Dominican Republic look at Cuba, they see a peaceful, agrarian, socialist society where the dictator has been overturned and the secret police have been sent packing, sometimes with their truncheons stuck up their fat asses.
Lee squalled laughter.
They see the great sugar plantations and the slave labor farms of United Fruit turned over to the farmers. They see Standard Oil sent packing. They see the casinos, all run by the Lenski mob. I know it, Lee said. Shut down. The donkey shows have stopped, mein friend, and the women who used to sell their bodies and their daughters' bodies have found honest work again. A peon who would have died in the streets under the pig Batista can now go to a hospital and be treated like a man. And why? Because under Fidel, the doctor and the peon stand as equals. I know it, Lee said. It was his default position.
De Morenschild leaped from the couch and began to pace around the new playpen.
Do you think Kennedy and his Irish cabal will let that billboard stand? That lighthouse flashing its message of hope?
I sort of like Kennedy, Lee said, as if embarrassed to admit it, in spite of the Bay of Pigs. That was Eisenhower's plan, you know.
Most of the GSA likes President Kennedy. You know what I mean by the GSA? I can assure you that the rabid she-weasel who wrote Atlas Shrugged knows. Great, stupid America. That's what I mean. The citizens of the USA will live happy and die content if they have a refrigerator that makes ice, two cars in their garage, and 77 Sunset Strip on their boob tubes. Great, stupid America loves Kennedy's smile, oh yes. Yes, indeed, he's a wonderful smile, I admit it. But did not Shakespeare say a man can smile and be a villain? Do you know that Kennedy has okayed a CIA plan to assassinate Castro? Yes, they've already tried and failed, thank God, 3 or 4 times. I have this from my oil contacts in Haiti and the DRLE, and it's good information.
Lee expressed dismay.
But Fidel has a strong friend in Russia, De Morenschild went on, still pacing. It isn't the Russia of Lenin's dreams, or yours or mine. But they may have their own reasons for standing with Fidel if America tries another invasion. And mark my words, Kennedy is apt to try it, and soon he'll listen to LeMay, he'll listen to Dulles, an Angleton of the CIA. All he needs is the right pretext, and then he'll go in just to show the world he's got balls.
They went on talking about Cuba. When the Cadillac returned, the rear seat was full of groceries, enough for a month, it looked like.
Oh, shit, Lee said. They're back. And we are glad to see them, De Morenschild said pleasantly.
Stay for dinner, Lee said. Rena's not much of a cook, but I must go. My wife is waiting anxiously for my report.